first lecturer of the school, former PI resident, Mark Geiler.
Okay, can you hear me? Yes. All right, so yeah, of course, let me start by thanking the organizers for putting together this school, which I think is a great idea. And also especially thanks to Aldo for the kind invitation to participate. And thank you for attending the lecture, and I hope you will enjoy it and stay until the end. And yes, so the topic is, at least the topic was announced as Noether's theorems and the gauge theories. And so it's of course a bit intimidating to talk about this because it's a very famous topic and old topic, and many people know it better than I do. And of course I did not contribute in any original way to this topic. So the best I can do is just, what I will try is just to give you a very personal presentation of some aspects of the topic which I think are interesting and which I use sometimes in my research. So it's just a patchwork of some things which I hope you will find interesting. And I think the maybe the best way to present this, so the aim, as Aldo said, is to go towards gauge theories and hopefully asymptotic symmetries in general relativity. But I think the best way to do this is to start from scratch so that we're all on the same page. So the plan will be to first start with Noether theorems in mechanics. So this will be today. And then hopefully tomorrow we'll move on to field theory. Already discussed tomorrow some aspects of conservation laws in general relativity. And then hopefully by Thursday we can move on to proper gauge theories and the Noether second theorem for gauge theories. So that's the tentative plan. Okay, so in particular you notice that maybe you already know that there is an S here, so it's a plural, because there are two theorems by Noether. When we talk about the role of symmetries and the relationship with conserved quantities, the first theorem typically applies to global symmetry, and it's the second theorem which tells us something interesting for the particular case of gauge theories. So as I said, so that we start on the same page, let's just start with mechanics and review some basic things which I think you already know, but I will try also to give maybe an interesting twist to this and present you some curiosities, interesting things already in mechanics. So the first thing is just Noether's first theorem. So the first theorem. So you already know, of course, I think that the Noether theorem is telling us about a relationship between symmetries of systems and conservation laws. And so to manipulate this, we will just need a very few technical things, so I want us to just agree on the notations and on what is going on. And the first object which we will, of course, manipulate a lot is just the notion of variations. We have to talk about what is a variation and what is actually being varied. And then from this, we will see how we can very quickly derive the first theorem. So we'll talk about variations. So yes, I should have said also, sorry, that I have written some notes and I will give you the notes at the end, maybe at the end of every session, every day, because the notes contains some details, some proofs of some calculations which we won't do on the blackboard. So you can consider this as a maybe an ongoing exercise session if you want. You can try yourself and prove the details, and all the proofs are in the notes. Okay, so variations. So as always, we will consider a configuration space with some generalized coordinates, which we will call QA, and a variation, what we will call a variation, is a displacement where we take qa of t to qa of t plus delta qa of t. So that's very simple. And why I want to insist on this is that, okay, I have to be careful about the writing. The important thing is that what is being varied in this, when we will write the theorem and talk about variational principle, is actually the fields themselves and not the coordinates. This will be important, and we will have to be a bit careful when we translate from variations of coordinates to variations of the fields. So for us, variation is just, you see like this, a variation of the field itself. Now from this, we can immediately derive something. We can derive the following variational formula. So to derive this variational formula, you can think of this as our master variational formula, which we will use to get the first theorem in mechanics, and then we will see an analogous of this formula in field theory and gauge field theories. So for this variational formula, we consider a Lagrangian. And let me write explicitly that this Lagrangian depends on q of t, q dot a of t, the velocity, and possibly the time itself explicitly. Now we can just use these variations, so these variations of the fields, apply these variations of the fields to the Lagrangian, and just use the chain rule to see what happens. So what we get is we compute the variation of the Lagrangian. And of course, this is partial L by partial QA, delta QA plus partial L by partial Q dot delta QA dot. And already here, you see that implicitly we're using an important property, which is that these variations, they actually commute with the time derivative. Using this, that the variation commutes with the time derivative, we can actually integrate this term by parts, as you know very well. This will isolate the Euler Lagrange equations and a boundary term. So we just integrate this by parts, and we get dL by dQA minus d by dt, dL by dQ dot A, and I take the variation out, and then we keep track of this total variation. Here we have dL by dQ dot A, delta QA. Okay, so it's a very simple formula, which you see we derived just by thinking about a little displacement of the field. So here the field is just the trajectory because we are in mechanics. So just by considering this variation of the trajectory, we apply this to the Lagrangian, use the chain rule, and derive this formula. So this is our master variational formula. So why this formula is interesting? Let me just rewrite it in the following way. So you recognize here, of course, the Euler-Lagrange equations. Let me just call this EA, EA delta QA. And this term, which is the total derivative, later on it will be very useful to call this term theta. So here is the variation of the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocity, so you know that this is the momentum conjugated to QA. So we will switch a bit between these notations later on. For the moment, let's call this theta. So you see that this formula, which is very elementary, is actually interesting because it relates three very different quantities. The first quantity is a, and these quantities are of very different nature. The first quantity is a variation. The second one is actually involving the equations of motion. And the third one is a boundary term. So these are three very different objects. This is why the formula is interesting, because since it relates three very different objects, if you manage to actually put a condition on one of these three objects, then by this formula, you get a relationship between the two other objects of the formula, right? In particular, you see that, you know very well that if you actually integrate this formula, you get
on the left-hand side the variation of the integral of the Lagrangian, which is the variation of the action. And then if you actually fix the variations on the endpoints, so you do something with this term which is here, then you get the Euler-Lagrange equations. Now, the other thing you can do, instead of fixing the variation on the endpoints, you can actually fix the equations of motion. You can look at this formula which is here, assume that you have a non-shell configuration, you have a solution of the equations of motion, this term drops. Again, you integrate the left and the right-hand side, and you will get a relationship between the variation of the action and this term which is here. Essentially, I'm not doing it for the sake of time, but the details are in the notes. This will actually lead you to the so-called Hamilton-Jacobi formula. So you get the Hamilton-Jacobi formulas, again, by considering this master variational formula and putting a constraint on this term by saying that you have a non-shell configuration. So we have said what happens when this term is determined, what happens when this term is determined. Now we can say what happens when this term is determined. This term is determined by what? Typically, it's determined when you have a symmetry of the system, because the symmetry of the theory means that the variation of the Lagrangian, this term, is a boundary term. And this is the case in which we can immediately derive from this formula the first theorem. Okay. So we get immediately to the first theorem. Okay, so to get the first theorem, we consider that we have a symmetry. So of course, you already know probably that just by looking at this equation, you know that there is this notion of cyclic coordinates, which is the fact that if the Lagrangian does not depend on one of the coordinates, then just by the Euler-Lagrange equation, you get that this thing is zero, so you get a conserved quantity, which is the term which is in here. So this is just a particular case of the first theorem, which says that, so if the Lagrangian satisfies delta epsilon L equals d by dt. So now, whenever we talk about symmetries, I will use this symbol epsilon to denote the symmetry parameter. So I'm performing a variation of the Lagrangian with some symmetry parameter, and I'm assuming that this is equal to a boundary term. This boundary term, let's just call it B epsilon. Now we plug this in this formula, which is here. Okay, so we compare this to, so that's one result, that if you have a symmetry, the variation is a boundary term. But the other result is that we have this also. So this is also, by virtue of our variational formula, it's also equal to this, d by dt. And now this, so we can allow ourselves to use kind of a mixed notation and just call this the momentum here. Let's call this P. So I just call this PA delta epsilon QI. Call it P, even though we're not in the Hamiltonian formulation. And now from this formula, you see, we immediately get that minus EA delta epsilon QA is equal to d by dt epsilon QA minus b epsilon. And we can call this Q now, d by dt of Q epsilon. And we get that this quantity Q epsilon, which we identify as this boundary term, is conserved when the equations of motion hold, which is just the statement of the first theorem. Okay? So now we have to make several remarks now that we have the first theorem. So the first is just to notice that, you see, from this master variational formula, we get the first theorem very easily. We didn't even write an action, in fact. We didn't derive the theorem by varying the action or by varying the time coordinates and the position and also the fields. So it's a very kind of streamlined and straightforward way to derive the first theorem. Yes, there was a question.
Manu.
Yeah, so earlier our theta was just PA del QA, right? And now we are saying that if we also include B epsilon in our theta. Because
No, so this is not theta anymore, right?
Oh, that's Q. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, yes, this is what we call Q now.
Okay,
yes.
Sorry.
Theta is just
PA del
Q. It's just P delta Q. But if I just have theta like this, I cannot say anything about theta if this variation is arbitrary, because here I also have the equations of motion and the variation of the Lagrangian.
Yeah.
So for this formula to say anything useful, I have to say that the variation of the Lagrangian is something very specific, which we have not. This, there's no example here, so this is not specified for the moment, but we'll see.
Thanks.
So now, several remarks. The first one is that in this presentation, I insisted in the beginning on the fact that we're varying the fields and not the coordinates. But now this can seem strange, because if we say that, we are kind of missing a straightforward application of the first theorem, which is that when the Lagrangian does not explicitly depend on time, I can do a time translation, and we get associated to this a constant quantity, which is the energy, or the Hamiltonian. But to derive this, when we say this, we are changing the time coordinate, which is not kind of falling within this framework. But we can, of course, do that. Variation of the coordinates. To do that, we have to just realize that whenever we are varying the coordinates, we can always repackage this as a variation of the fields themselves, which sometimes some people call a true variation. And this is actually always possible, and we will give several examples of this. So in the case of time translations, so I'm being very kind of pedantic about the notations now, so that everything is explicit. So I'm sending the time coordinate to a new time t bar, which is the old time. I choose a minus sign here, minus epsilon. And then let's say that the trajectories transform in this way. Qa of t becomes q bar a of t bar, which is q bar a of t minus epsilon. But this, at the end of the day, is just equal to qa of t, because for the time translations, we're not actually changing the trajectory itself. We're just changing the time coordinate. So now, by just combining these two this part of the equation, from here, you just get that delta qa of t is just to first order epsilon q dot a of t. So see, we are just able to repackage this transformation of the coordinate into a variation of the field. And then just as an exercise, you can check that, again, all the details are in the notes, but presumably you're familiar with this. You can just take this transformation for any Lagrangian which does not explicitly depend on time. And then using this, you will find that this quantity q epsilon, which by the first theorem is conserved on shell, is equal to the Hamiltonian, or rather epsilon times the Hamiltonian if you keep this explicit. Okay, so this was the first remark. The second remark is about trivial symmetries. So what I mean by trivial symmetries here is just notice the fact that if this transformation of the field, here the position, so for any variation which has this form, delta epsilon acting on QA is epsilon AB, can maybe depend on the position or on the time or on anything you want, times QB of T, if this is anti-symmetric, well, notice that if you take a variation of this form with epsilon, which can even depend on time and on space if you want, which is anti-symmetric, then it seems that you get a symmetry of the theory, right? Because you plug this variation in here. Sorry. Of course, this should be the equation of motion, not the trajectory. Okay, if you plug this in this variational formula, which is here, this term here, well, you get delta epsilon L, you get that this is EA EB epsilon AB plus PA delta epsilon QA. But now this term is vanishing because this is anti-symmetric, and here we have twice the equations of motion. This is symmetric, this is anti-symmetric. So it seems that you get a symmetry. However, if you also, as an exercise, compute the conserved quantity for this symmetry, well, it's the reason why you create a trivial symmetry. There is no conserved quantity associated to this. More generally, you can show that whenever the variation is actually vanishing on shell, this will lead to a trivial symmetry in this sense. The Noether charge is actually identically vanishing. But I mention this because later on, we will actually encounter an example of these trivial symmetries where we have to realize that what is actually involved is precisely a trivial symmetry. And if you don't notice this, then we get into a long calculation to realize that there's some contribution which is actually vanishing. Now, the second remark is that there is a slight shortcut to compute actually the Noether charge associated to a symmetry. If you look back at the formula which was here before, they just erased, you will notice that we can, to get the Noether charge, you can simply compute this quantity. You can just compute, so minus the equations of motion and the variation of the field, if this is equal to a boundary term, here you get the Noether charge. Because with the formula that we gave earlier, to compute this Q, we have to first compute the variation of the Lagrangian, realize that it's a boundary term, and then subtract this boundary term from the potential from theta, so P delta Q, evaluated on the transformation. But at the end of the day, what you're doing is just computing this thing here. You just have one term to compute. You compute this, and then it's immediate that two things can happen. Either this is not a total time derivative, in this case you don't have a symmetry, and if this happens to be a total derivative, then this transformation is a symmetry, and you read immediately the Noether charge. So it's just a shortcut which is sometimes useful, especially in the examples that we discuss in a minute. Okay. And the last remark is about so-called Lagrangian gauge transformations. So you know that given a Lagrangian that leads to some equations of motion, if you shift this Lagrangian by a boundary term, you get equivalent equations of motion. You're not changing the dynamics of the system. So because of this, you also expect that you get the same symmetries from these two Lagrangians and the same conserved quantities. Well, you can check explicitly, again, the details are in the notes, but I just mentioned it here, that if you define L prime to be L plus d by dt of a boundary term, then if L has some symmetry that leads to some Noether charge, then L prime has the same symmetries and the same Noether charge. You can explicitly go through these formulas again. You will find the same Noether charge for L prime as you found for L. I mention this because later on, when we talk about gauge theories, this will not necessarily be the case. We will have to be careful about the role of the boundary terms. But in mechanics, everything works fine. we have this invariance under these so-called Lagrangian gauge transformations. So now, yes? Oh yes, this can be literally anything. Yes. In field theory, in principle, it can also be anything, but depending on what it is, you have to be very careful about how to compute this.
Can you repeat the question for the online audience, please?
The question was whether this boundary term L can depend on Q and Q dot. Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes. How am I doing on time, by the way?
So it's 9:35.
Okay, thanks.
You have an hour.
Okay, cool. Okay. Yeah, again, I hope this is, of course, understandable. I'm skipping lots of details which are in the notes, so you can find all the intermediate calculations in the notes. So now we move on to just the next section, 1.2, the Hamiltonian formulation. By the way, we will give examples just after that. We just discussed briefly the Hamiltonian formulation, and then we will give explicit examples of the application of the theorem to go from symmetries to conserved quantities. And the point about the Hamiltonian formulation is that it enables us to actually compute what is sometimes called the inverse Noether theorem, which is the statement that if you have some conserved quantity on phase space, then you can show that this conserved quantity is actually inducing a transformation, which is the symmetry of the theory. So it goes a bit the other way around. Instead of starting from the symmetry and deriving the conserved charge, you start from a conserved charge and you derive a symmetry transformation. So to show this, we just have to recall that when we have a Lagrangian, we can perform a Legendre transform and exhibit what we could call the phase space structure. So this is just writing the Lagrangian as PA Q dot A minus H. If you write this, we get, of course, as you know, we get this form of the equations of motion, dH by d, PA, let's put the minus outside, EQA, P dot A, plus dH by dQA, and now the boundary term, which, okay, now we can explicitly call this P, the momentum. Earlier, remember this was dL by dQ dot, now this is just P. Okay, so this is just the Hamiltonian form of the Lagrangian obtained by a Legendre transform. And this is the form of the equations of motion, which are first order now, because we have switched to the Hamiltonian formulation. So now the statement of the inverse theorem. Theorem is that if you have a quantity Q that satisfies this, so partial derivative of Q plus the Poisson bracket between Q and H equals zero. So by the way, this is the total time derivative of Q, which again is made up of a partial derivative, then the Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian. If this is vanishing, then you can show that this transformation defined in this way, so on the coordinate Q, so this is just a definition now, you define this as being QA Poisson bracket with Q epsilon. And on P, you define this in the same way, Poisson bracket between Q and P. So if you have a quantity Q on phase space which satisfies this, Then you define this transformation, which is the action of Q by Poisson bracket on small q and small p. Then you can check explicitly using this formula. You plug this into this formula, you massage this a bit, and you use this property here, and you will find that this gives you a symmetry of the Lagrangian. And if you apply, so just by the form of this equation, you will read immediately that the Noether charge for this symmetry is precisely this conserved quantity we started with. Okay, so everything is as it should be. So from this, you can explicitly check as an exercise that this variation is equal to d by dt of Pa delta epsilon qa minus q. It's equal to this, right? And now this tells you immediately that this is the Noether charge, right? Because if you remember the formula we had for the first theorem in Lagrangian form, well, this is what we call B, right? The boundary term produced by the symmetry transformation of L. So this is B. And we said that the Noether charge was this quantity, which we call theta, evaluated on the transformation, minus B. Okay? So if you do this minus this, which is B, you get Q epsilon. So that's the inverse theorem. One nice property is that if you exhibit on the phase space of some mechanical system, and we will see later in the week what happens for field theory and especially gauge field theory, but here is just a mechanical system. If you exhibit on the phase space of this mechanical system several conserved quantities, which generate symmetries in this way, well, then these conserved quantities automatically form a Lie algebra. Again, you can explicitly prove this. Let me just write this in the following way, that you have a conserved charge Qi and Qj. If you compute their Poisson bracket, you will find that this is, again, equal to a conserved charge. So this means that by construction, if you exhibit two conserved charges, well, you can always compute their Poisson bracket, and you can show that the Poisson bracket of two conserved charges is again a conserved charge. So in other words, the Poisson bracket of two symmetries gives you once again a symmetry. Depending on what are the structural coefficients here, this Poisson bracket might be zero, it might give you something which was already here, or it might give you something new. If it gives you something new, it means that you have exhibited a new symmetry generator. Okay, so I think we can move to the examples to make this a bit more explicit. So, are there questions? Yes.
No. There's no need to shout loud. You really need.
Ah, yeah.
You might. You can keep it.
Yeah. So, is it obvious that any set of conserved charges will always form an algebra, or that is some deeper fact?
I cannot say if it's obvious or not, because it's a calculation, but the calculation is not complicated. The calculation amounts to showing that the Poisson bracket of two conserved quantities is again a conserved quantity.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So you know what it means to be a conserved quantity. It means to satisfy this.
Okay.
You know how to give a meaning to the Poisson bracket of any two phase space functions, because you know the phase space structure. So by combining these ingredients, you can just show that you have two conserved quantities. The Poisson bracket is again a conserved quantity.
Okay. Thanks.
Now the question, maybe it will be interesting to actually exhibit examples of this. So this is what we want to do now. Exhibit simple examples of these non-trivial algebraic structures. So let's do this. Okay, so let's move to the examples. So this is 1.3. Examples. So the first example is, I had a whole section about the free particle, because you can already do interesting things. I just mentioned the first point. which is, let's start with the free particle. So the position, I want to be in three dimensions so that we can also talk about angular momentum. So the position is now a vector, and the Lagrangian is 1/2 of q dot squared. Yes, let's use these notations. Where this is the norm of this of the velocity vector. So now there are very simple symmetries and conservation laws for this Lagrangian, of course. One, so a very simple one would be what would be, so how, what would be one obvious symmetry and conserved quantity here? The time translation, right? Someone said it. So from time translation, you get the conserved quantity, which is the energy of the Hamiltonian. Now you also have rotations, right? You can compute delta epsilon of q as the wedge product between a vector epsilon, or the cross product between the vector epsilon and the position q. If epsilon does not depend on time, this is a symmetry of this Lagrangian. You can just, again, check with the formulas we had before, that you get a conserved quantity associated to this. The conserved quantity is the angular momentum. This gives you q, which is, so now I'm acting with a vector here. So these are vector identities. So we get three conserved quantities. So p cross q. So now there is another invariance, which is, so that's why I wanted to talk about the free particle, which sometimes we don't talk about in textbooks. It's very trivial, but just to do it explicitly, because it has a property which we have not seen explicitly so far on these two examples. And this extra symmetry is invariance under Galilean boost, right? So this is just non-relativistic mechanics. So you can perform Galilean boost. So Galilean changes of the velocity. And associated to this Galilean boost, you also get a conserved quantity. So let's compute this conserved quantity. So Galilean boost. Let me denote this in the following way. So the boost, they don't change the time coordinate, of course, in a non-relativistic setting. That's why it's a Galilean boost. But q of t goes to, let's call it, well, epsilon again, q of t plus epsilon times t. Right, you could check that this is actually the symmetry of this Lagrangian. And then what is the conserved quantity associated to this? Again, you use the formula we had before, plug this in the Lagrangian, find that it's a boundary term, you derive the conserved quantity, and you will find that q epsilon is actually q minus t q dot. Okay. So this is interesting because it's an explicit example of a conserved quantity, which is associated to a completely obvious symmetry, right? These Galilean boosts. But this conserved quantity has the property that it explicitly depends on time. It depends on time explicitly. However, it's still a conserved quantity. You compute the total time derivative of this. You will see that you will hit q to get q dot. You will also hit t. Okay, so these two contributions will cancel. And then you will get a t q dot dot. So by the equations of motion, which are q dot dot equals zero, this charge is conserved on shell as it should be. T, this is minus t q dot dot,
this is equal to zero on shell. Oh, by the way, this hatted equality means on shell. Okay. So it's just an example to show that, of course, conserved quantities can be explicitly time dependent. There is no problem with that. The only thing they have to satisfy is that they are conserved on shell. Now the second example is a bit more interesting because it has more structure and it actually takes place, it actually happens already in one spatial dimension. So just a particle, a non-relativistic particle in one dimension. And this example is called the conformal particle. Okay, so for this example, let's write an action. Okay, for the moment we have only written Lagrangians. Now it's important that we think a bit about both the action and the Lagrangian to understand what is happening. Okay, we consider the following action, S, integral over dt, q dot squared, and let's call this minus k over q squared. So this 1 over q squared potential, this is what is called the conformal potential. And you will see in a minute why it's called a conformal potential or why this is the conformal particle. So there is one obvious symmetry again, which is invariance under time translations, which leads to the Hamiltonian. So we already know that we have time translations, and that this gives a conserved quantity, Q naught, which is the Hamiltonian. Sometimes I will do that, forgive me, but it should be clear to you. I use kind of a mixed notation, for example, here, where I'm writing something in Hamiltonian form, but I'm still using, it's not very precise because I'm still using the velocity here, okay? But to show that this is a conserved quantity, you can do this at the level of the phase space, working with the momentum p, or you can do this explicitly on configuration space and using the velocity, which is here. Just that this equality can seem a bit strange, but as long as we know what we're writing, it's okay. So now, in addition to this symmetry, there is a scaling symmetry. We could call this a Weyl symmetry. So this symmetry acts in the following way. So for the symmetry, now I have to also transform the time coordinates. So t goes to t bar using the same notations as before. And this t bar is lambda t. And now the trajectory, q of t, goes to q bar of t bar, which is square root lambda times qt. And now you can observe that under this transformation, this scaling symmetry, where I'm transforming now both the time coordinate and the dynamical variable, this actually leaves the action invariant, because the scaling of this is inverse to the scaling of dt. So if you do this, you get that the action is invariant. However, you see that in order for the action to be invariant, which already tells us that even though before we introduced the Noether theorem at the level of the Lagrangian, we could have done this at the level of the action. It's just that we carry more kind of decorations around which are not useful to actually derive the theorem. But the fact that we have this tells us that we have, this is a symmetry, and we have a conserved quantity associated to this. That's what we want to compute. However, there is something a bit peculiar, which is that in order for this to be true, you see that you have to transform dt also. So the Lagrangian itself is not invariant under this transformation. The Lagrangian picks up a rescaling factor, which is compensated by the dt, which is here. However, the other peculiar thing is that if you now write this transformation in terms of a true variation of the field only, not a variation involving the field and the coordinates, and you linearize this transformation to go to the infinitesimal level, you will find that this is a symmetry of the Lagrangian. So let's check this explicitly. Yeah, we can combine these two transformations to show that, so with the proper signs, this gives a transformation of the field, which is epsilon over 2 q of t minus epsilon t q dot of t. I hope you can see what's here, okay? So epsilon over 2 q minus epsilon t q dot. Okay, and now you can use this to show that the Lagrangian transforms as a giving a boundary term. So this is a symmetry of the Lagrangian. And the boundary term, you will find that this is minus epsilon d of TL by dt. So once again, this conserved quantity is explicitly time dependent. T is here, and it's t times the Lagrangian. But it's a genuine symmetry of the theory, so we can compute a Noether charge. And the Noether charge that you get from this, so this one was called Q0. Let's call this one Q1 now. So the Noether charge you find from this, Q1, is 1 half of m QQ dot minus T Q naught. So the Hamiltonian appears here again. The Hamiltonian, we called it Q naught. So we have Q0, and now we have a new charge Q1. And again, you can take the total time derivative of this and check that on shell of the equations of motion, this is a conserved quantity, as is guaranteed by the Noether first theorem. Okay, so now why is this interesting? Because the fact that we have these two conserved quantities now, and the fact that one of them depends explicitly on time, actually enables us to solve the dynamics of the system without actually really solving the differential equation, which is the equation of motion, just by combining these conserved quantities. So in the following way, you combine these conserved quantities, and you will find that the solution takes this form. So you can find that Q of t is actually plus minus the square root of 2 Q1 plus T Q0 squared plus Km divided by M Q0. So if you take this Lagrangian, you compute the LR Lagrange equations, you solve explicitly the equation, you will find the solution, which is exactly this one, with two integration constants, which are Q0 and Q1. But here we didn't have to do that. You can just combine these two conserved quantities. The fact that this one depends on time, you combine them to get this, which is the correct physical trajectory. Okay, so now can we go further? Is there even maybe more structure than that? It turns out that there is more structure. And to see this, we can actually compute a finite transformation acting on the action. So this is just to illustrate a technique which you may one day need to use. So that's a trick to ask if maybe there are even more symmetries, which you could call hidden symmetries because they're not extremely manifest. Although I don't like this term because, well, they're not more hidden than this one. But to do that, you can consider the following transformation. We can actually take these transformation laws and make them even more general by considering that this lambda here is an arbitrary function of time. And let's see what happens if we do that. Just take this lambda to be an arbitrary function of time, plug this in the action, massage the result a bit, and see what comes out. So we consider the following transformation. T goes to f of t. So dt goes to f dot dt. and we take q of t to go to, so square root of f dot times q of t. Okay, and with this you will find that, right, so these two are just a generalization of the transformation law we had here, right? Lambda and square root lambda. So this is what tells me that I take here f and yes, lambda square root lambda. F and the square root here, and now we compute q dot, and here we get that q dot goes to q dot by f dot 1/2 plus 1/2 f double dot by f dot 3/2 q of t. Okay. Now you take these transformations, you plug them in the action, and when you plug this in the action, you will find that the action transforms in the following way. You will find that the action goes to itself plus m over 4 times, so dt, d by dt of f double dot over f dot q squared. So that's a total derivative, okay? So if we just had this, we would be happy because this would be a symmetry because it sends the action to the action plus a boundary term. But there is an extra term here, which is, let me call it like that. It's this. So what is this extra term? It's something which in mathematics is known as the Schwarzian derivative. It's the Schwarzian derivative of this free function of time f of t, and this Schwarzian derivative is defined in the following way. This is a triple derivative of f divided by f dot minus 3/2 f dot dot over f dot squared. So it's a kind of a strange, peculiar formula which involves the third derivative and then the square of the second derivative. It's a bit something strange, but which you will see has very interesting properties. And I just mentioned this because this is a very kind of simple toy example where this Schwarzian appears just in ordinary mechanics. And maybe depending on what you're working on, I don't know, maybe you have already seen in the literature that in field theory, especially in two-dimensional quantum gravity, this Schwarzian plays a very important role. Because this Schwarzian is related to SL2R symmetry, and we will see here that indeed this model has full SL2R symmetry. So where this SL2R symmetry comes from? It comes essentially from the fact that this Schwarzian has the strange property that it is invariant under the linear group modded by Z2. So it's a bit strange, but we can check this explicitly. So for, if you take a function of this form, let's call this AF plus B CF plus D. So you do this GL2R transformation of the function F. Okay. With this, you just need the determinant to be non-vanishing so that this is in GL2R. With this, you get that the Schwarzian of G is actually the Schwarzian of F. So it's a very kind of very surprising transformation behavior of this, which is one of the reasons why this Schwarzian derivative is singled out, because it has this GL2R by Z2 invariance. So this means in particular that one can check explicitly that what this implies is that this Schwarzian, which is here, will actually vanish if the function f is a third degree polynomial in time. So if it's a third degree polynomial, it means that we have three coefficients to play with. Two of the coefficients, actually, we have already seen them in these guys. They give rise to two symmetries. One of them leads to Q naught, the other one leads to Q1, but there is actually a third one. This is one of the ways at the level of the action to reveal this third symmetry and the associated conserved quantity. It's by computing this general transformation and finding that you indeed get a symmetry if this extra term is vanishing. Okay. Yes, so to get this, you can actually take the symmetry to have this form. If the symmetry is acting in the following way, so delta epsilon acting on Q, so you take this transformation law. You take epsilon dot of t times Q of t, and then minus epsilon of t Q dot of t, with what you need is that you need epsilon of t to have this form, minus epsilon naught plus epsilon 1 t, and then minus epsilon 2 t2. And I realized that earlier I said third degree polynomial. Of course, it's not the third derivative has to vanish. It has to be a second degree polynomial. That's why we have three integration, three free parameters here, epsilon 0, epsilon 1, epsilon 2. And so this is the time translation invariance that leads to the charge Q naught. This epsilon 1 parametrizes the symmetry which leads to the charge Q1 that we had earlier. And this one will give to a new charge that we will call Q2. And if you compute this, so you take this transformation here, you can actually check explicitly. So now, so this is typically an example where to check this, it's much more economical to use this little shortcut that we mentioned earlier. And again, the shortcut was just to take the Euler-Lagrange equation. So there is just one equation here, and we just compute this. So Euler-Lagrange equation times delta epsilon Q. If this is a boundary term, you have a symmetry. And this is indeed a boundary term. This is equal to dq epsilon by dt. And you find that q epsilon is, so suggestively, epsilon naught q naught plus epsilon 1 q1 plus epsilon 2 q2. The signs here are just chosen such that this is true. So q0, we already have it. Q1, we already had it. But now Q2, by this computation, you find that Q2 is given by this. Q2 is given by Q2 is 1 half m Q squared minus 2t. So if you remember, Q1 was already linear in time, and the contribution was t times the Hamiltonian, t times q naught. Q2 is actually quadratic in time. So it has a linear piece here. It also has a quadratic piece. So minus t2 q naught. So this is another conserved quantity for this conformal particle, which, as we said, one way to reveal this is to do this general transformation and see the condition for which this gives you a symmetry. Okay. Now what you can check is that at the Hamiltonian level, you can check that these three conserved quantities, Q0, Q1, Q2, they form an SL2R algebra. So you can check that the following Poisson bracket. Q1 on Q0 gives Q0. Q1 on Q2 gives minus Q2. And Q0 on Q2 gives minus 2Q1. And this, up to some redefinition, is actually identically the SL2R algebra. Okay, but now it's also strange because, in fact, we have to remember that the system is two-dimensional. The phase space is two-dimensional. So it's a one-dimensional particle. The phase space is two-dimensional, but you have exhibited here three conserved quantities. So these conserved quantities, they cannot be independent. And in fact, they are not independent. And the relationship between them is given by just computing the Casimir of this SL2R algebra. So there is a Casimir relation between these conserved charges, and the relationship is the following. If you compute Q naught times Q2 minus Q1 squared, you will find that this is Km over 2. This is the nonlinear relationship connecting these conserved quantities. Okay? 10, 12. I have 15 minutes. Okay. Yes, because now to move on, I wanted to mention, so finish with, again, two examples. And these examples involve actually celestial mechanics. So by the way, this thing has of course been known for a long time, although you don't find it in many textbooks. But it's an example of what people call we call this the ADS1 CFT0 correspondence. CFT0 because this is called conformal quantum mechanics. So there are these old papers from the 70s, I think. The references are in the notes again, if you want to look at this. And this is called conformal quantum mechanics. And the conformal nature comes from these algebraic structures which you have on the classical phase space. Then you could ask what happens to these structures in the quantum theory, but that's something we won't get into. Okay, so another example now is so-called similarities.
Matt, yes? Before we meet, I have a question. Just before the most general example with epsilon 0, 1, 2, the relation we got was that particular example would be a symmetry if the short chain vanishes. Mm-hmm. And then we showed that any GLN transformation of if something, the short chain remains the same. So yes. In those cases, are there like an infinite family of symmetries? Like because if you can find one, then you can do a linear transformation and then the short chain would vanish even for that case. And then that would also be a symmetry.
In fact, yes, it's true. You can actually even recombine these transformations to make the symmetry group even larger. But because of this, see, the same thing will happen as what already happens with these three charges. You will build conserved quantities which are not independent. So there are actually examples. In the notes, you even find this for the free particle. For the free non-relativistic particle, you can actually exhibit infinitely many conserved quantities. But these conserved quantities, they are kind of trivially conserved and trivially related to one another. They are just combinations of powers of one another.
I see.
So it doesn't encode any truly interesting structure. However, some similar structures will appear later on, for example, in general relativity. And this is where it will be more interesting.
And also when we generalize that to the epsilon 0, 1, 2 transformation, which part of that transformation did we impose that the short chain of F, something like that, is 0? Means we chose some particular structure there?
No, the structure was just that it's a second degree polynomial.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and for the second degree polynomial, short chain is 0.
Yes.
Okay.
That's just the structure.
Yeah, okay.
So now let me briefly discuss the similarities. So it's a bit exotic, but it's also kind of an interesting application of the Noether theorem to a case in which it would seem that you have a symmetry, but it's not actually covered by the Noether theorem in its usual form. And you will see what this is. So these similarity transformations. So consider the following Lagrangian. I take a Lagrangian, which is 1/2 of m q dot squared minus k q to the alpha. So instead of taking the conformal potential as we did earlier, I take just alpha to be arbitrary and see what happens when alpha is arbitrary. Um, Now you consider also the scalings, which are the following. T goes to T bar equals lambda 2 minus alpha T. Okay. Q of T goes to lambda squared Q of T. So just the scaling of time and the scaling of the position. If you do this, you will find that the Lagrangian scales as, so L goes to lambda to the 2 alpha L. And S goes to lambda alpha plus 2 S. So this is what we said earlier, right? That even in the particular case of the conformal potential, alpha is minus 2, so the action is invariant. The Lagrangian is not invariant. However, we still get a symmetry. Here it's not completely the case, because if you, again, you can combine. So now, again, I insist, and this is explicitly transforming the time coordinate. To apply the Noether theorem, we don't want to mix transformations of time and the position, otherwise we get all confused about how we should phrase the theorem. We just go back to variations of the fields, and then everything is clear. We cannot make a mistake. So we go back to variations, true variations of the fields, which at the infinitesimal level take this form. So delta epsilon of q, this is just 2 epsilon q plus alpha minus 2 epsilon t q dot. Okay, that's just that's the transformation of Q. And from this, you can check now that the transformation of the Lagrangian is the following one. You get epsilon alpha plus 2 times L plus epsilon alpha minus 2 d of TL by dt. So again, you see that something peculiar happens when alpha is equal to minus 2, and only in that case. That's the case of the conformal potential that we studied before. In this case, the Lagrangian is really invariant. This transformation really gives a boundary term. We really have a symmetry. But if alpha is different from minus 2, well, the transformation of the Lagrangian spits out the Lagrangian again. So this is related to the fact that at the finite level, the Lagrangian changes by the scaling. But surely, if you take the Lagrangian and you perform a scaling of the Lagrangian, the equations of motion are the same. So this should actually be considered as a symmetry. Said it differently, if you compute the equations of motion coming from this, the equations of motion, they are invariant under these transformations. And in fact, you can also notice that in the case of the Newtonian potential, when alpha is minus 1, these transformations here, when alpha is minus 1, so t scales as lambda cube, q scales as lambda squared, this invariance of the Newtonian equations under the scaling is just, in fact, it's this, you can think of this as the symmetry which implies the Kepler's third law, right? Because the third law is a statement about, right, the square of the orbital period and the cube of the semi-minor axis. And the fact that this relationship holds, you can think of this as being rooted in the fact that the theory has the invariance under this scaling. But if you try to make sense of this, see, in terms of the Noether theorem, you get a bit into this problem that, well, you have this scaling which just gives a dilatation of the Lagrangian. So the transformation is this. However, you can still meaningfully associate a conserved quantity to this by slightly generalizing the Noether theorem. And the way to do that is to just notice that so this is the transformation of the Lagrangian, and now to apply the Noether theorem, you can just check that, let's do it the other way around. You can check that the following quantity is actually conserved. And you will see what is peculiar in this conserved quantity. So this is 2mq q dot plus alpha minus 2. So again, this is explicitly time dependent. There is the time times the Hamiltonian here. And then you have minus alpha plus 2 and this non-local term, which is actually the integral of the Lagrangian. You integrate the Lagrangian here. And this is the integral of the Lagrangian. You should think of this as being evaluated on a solution of the equations of motion, because all we care about is that this charge is actually conserved on shell. And explicitly, you can take this formula and check that this charge is indeed conserved on shell, just using the fact that the derivative acting on this gives you the Lagrangian. If you compute, you use this, you compute d by dt, you will find that this is alpha plus 2 mq dot squared minus h minus l. And written in this form, you see, you get, this is like the Legendre transform of the Hamiltonian, even though this is written in terms of the velocity. But this is L minus L, so this is indeed vanishing. So this is indeed a conserved quantity, which is the conserved quantity associated to these scaling transformations of the Lagrangian, which sometimes people call similarities. Okay. And now, the last thing I wanted to mention here by the way, this is also an example. Maybe I can tell you what this is actually equal to. For alpha equals 2, I erased it, but for alpha equals 2, the potential was q to the alpha. For alpha equals 2, this is just the harmonic oscillator. If you compute this for the harmonic oscillator, you find the conserved charge, but this conserved charge is a bit trivial. It's 2m times the initial position times the initial velocity. Okay, which is kind of trivially conserved, but nonetheless, you have an explicit symmetry of the Lagrangian, which produces this conserved quantity. Sorry, for alpha equals 2, you get this, you get that q is 2m q naught v naught. You can also check this explicitly as an example. Now I just mentioned one last thing, which is the Newtonian potential. So the only thing I wanted to mention here is that in the case of the Newtonian potential, so now, for example, we are in celestial mechanics. So again, we go to the physically meaningful. Why did I write this potential? The physically meaningful three-dimensional case. And you may be familiar with this old theorem from the 19th century called the Bertrand theorem, which is saying that out of all the potentials that you could consider, the only one which is vanishing at infinity and which leads to closed orbits is the Newtonian potential. If you don't require that the potential is vanishing at infinity, but just leads to closed orbits, you also have the harmonic oscillator. But if you want the potential to vanish, the only possibility is the Newtonian potential. You can only show, maybe you know this, but I recall a proof of this in the notes, that if you have the Newtonian potential, only in this case, you get an extra conserved quantity, in fact, a conserved vector, which is called the Laplace-Runge-Lenz vector. And this conserved quantity is very interesting because it also enables you, as we did before, to kind of trivially solve the equations of motion. So let me just mention this. So using the angular momentum, so just for my notations, I just take this to be, I put the mass explicitly, q dot squared. And the potential, I think I called it plus k over q. Now we consider the angular momentum, j, I take the sign like this, plus p. We define the, so LRL is Lorentz Runge-Lenz vector. Let me, sorry, Laplace Runge-Lenz. Runge-Lenz vector. And the definition of this vector is the following. So sometimes people call it A. So this is P cross J minus Km over the norm of Q times Q. And you can explicitly check that this is a conserved vector, this is a conserved quantity, and that the conservation of this actually follows from the fact that the potential is central and Newtonian. So you can do it the other way around. You can start with this quantity, assume nothing about the potential, you compute its time evolution, you will find that it's only conserved if the potential is central and 1 over Q. Now there is another vector, which is even less known than the Laplace-Runge-Lenz vector, which is called the Hamilton vector. The Hamilton vector, let's call it B. This is defined as P minus, so there are of course some choices of normalizations in here. So the norm of Q, the norm of the angular momentum squared, J cross Q. And now using these vectors, you can actually check explicitly that, well, they're not all independent, they satisfy a bunch of algebraic relationships. For example, the following one. You could check that A dot J is equal to B dot J is equal to A dot B is equal to 0. You could check that J cross A is equal to the norm of J times B. J cross B is minus A. And A cross B is the norm of B times J. The other thing, which will be important in a minute, is that we actually don't need that. It's fine. Yes, so the interesting point about this conserved quantity, now I get to the point. The interesting thing about this conserved quantity, the Laplace-Runge-Lenz vector, is that if you compute A dot Q, okay, so this is A Q cos theta, this is also J squared minus KMQ. And just from this alone, you get immediately that, from this you get immediately that 1 over Q is Km over J squared, 1 plus, let me write it, Km cos theta. So this is, you recognize here the form of the Keplerian trajectories, and this is what we call the eccentricity usually. So the eccentricity is actually related to a K here, the mass, and the norm of the Runge-Lenz vector. And you see that you immediately get this trajectory just by the knowledge that you have this conserved quantity and computing this scalar product here. And the last thing I mention is that, again, there is some non-trivial algebraic structure on the phase space here, and you see this by computing Poisson brackets. What you see is that, of course, if you compute, so now these quantities are three-dimensional vectors, so let me just write the components now. So one component of the angular momentum with another one. This is epsilon ABC JC. Right? This is just a three-dimensional rotations generated by the angular momentum. And then if you, let me just stick to this one. Yes, if you take the components of the
Laplace-Runge lens vector, A with the angular momentum, you find that this closes on the Laplace-Runge lens vector. And if you take A with A, you find that this closes on the angular momentum up to a factor which actually depends on the energy, epsilon ABC JC. So you see that these quantities form an algebra. So the angular momentum, of course, you know that the angular momentum by itself forms a subalgebra of this big algebra. But then you can include the Laplace-Runge lens vector, and you get this bigger algebra. And this is also an example of an algebra whose nature kind of depends on the dynamics that you're looking at. Because you know that in this planetary motion, the dynamics is actually, the family of dynamics is fixed by the sign of the energy, the Hamiltonian. And you see that this Hamiltonian, the sign appears here. So this algebra actually depends on the type of trajectories that you're considering. If the energy is vanishing, this algebra is actually the Poincaré algebra. If H is, so I always confuse the signs. Yes, with there's, yes, if H is negative, this is the SO4 algebra. SO4. If H is equal to 0, this is SO21. If H is positive, this is SO31. So the full Lorentz algebra if H is positive. Okay, so this is just again illustrating these algebraic structures which follow from the presence of conserved quantities on the phase space of some very simple systems already like the Newtonian potential. And then you can actually, of course, people have used this, you can go on and you can actually use this and the representation theory of this algebra to say some interesting things about the classical dynamics of these systems. Of course, here we know everything that can be known about the classical dynamics of the Newtonian theory, but you can derive some of these results using these algebraic methods. Okay, and the last thing. So now we could also go further, and but now this is just an exercise because there is not nothing else to discover here. You could also compute, for example, the action by Poisson bracket of the Laplace-Runge lens vector A on the position Q. Yes? Ah, yes. 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 Yes, thanks. Thanks. And yes, you could compute the action by Poisson bracket of the Laplace-Runge lens vector on the position. So just as an exercise to check the application of this inverse Noether theorem. Well, I don't write the formula, it's in the notes, but I encourage you to do this as an exercise because it's okay, there are a few steps of calculations, but you will find, of course, by construction, that if you act now, if you define this, now this is a vector, if you define this as the Poisson bracket of epsilon contracted with A, so A is a vector, so I get actually three symmetries. So I can parameterize this with three parameters. The generator is just this dot product of the parameters with A, with the vector. You act with this on the position Q. You compute what this is. Then you plug these transformations in the Lagrangian. You find that it's a symmetry. And if you compute the corresponding Noether charge, well, if everything works well, you find again that the corresponding Noether charge is just what you started from, because of the inverse Noether theorem that we mentioned earlier. But if you do this, you will just, it's interesting to see that this transformation is a bit non-trivial. This is also, I think, the reason why sometimes the Laplace-Runge lens vector is not mentioned, or the Hamilton vector, you can check the same structure. Sometimes it's not mentioned because the action on the trajectories is not very explicit. So sometimes also that's the reason why
I think sometimes people call these symmetries hidden symmetries or things like that, because they're not very obvious. They're not related to any obvious invariance of the system. But the important point is that the fact that this conserved quantity exists is related to the fact that the Keplerian orbits are closed. So you can think of this as being the kind of the physical reason why this conserved quantity exists. And that's interesting, I think. Okay, there are two more examples in the notes, so I don't cover them. There are other exotic examples of what you can do just in mechanics, but I think we covered the first part about mechanics. So tomorrow we can move on to field theory and to general relativity. So if there are questions, you can.
Any further question? Okay, if not, let's thank Mark. And-